most spectacular apology in the world, he's incapable of true change. By the time I returned to my apartment 3 blocks away, my letter of resignation had already been hand-delivered. It was signed by Sandy Litvak. I spent a quiet birthday at home in Brentwood with Judy and our 3 children. For once, I didn't answer the phone. Then I flew to Aspen for a week to be alone and think. I was livid with Eisner and furious at myself. I felt awful, worthless, an utter failure. Intellectually, I knew it wasn't my fault. From the moment of the ambush in Bel Air, Michael had withheld the support he'd promised. It had been deliberate and cruelly so, but I couldn't process what had happened intellectually. The emotions were too strong. Betrayal really sets me off. I had to walk out of the movie Betrayal, based on the Harold Pinter play about a man who carries on a long affair with his friend's wife, because it stirred up so many churning feelings. My dad once told me, "You give your all to your friends and clients, and you expect the same back, but you're not going to get it. They'll betray you." I was in sales, I know. I had argued with him then, but now I decided he was right. A week of hard thinking about Michael Eisner wasn't nearly enough. It took me half a year to feel normal again, and longer than that to make sense of Michael's behavior. I think he was sincere when he wooed me in his weakened post-surgical state, but then Michael recovered, and the better he felt, the worse I looked to him. I was 4 years younger and vastly more energetic. Ovitz the savior became Ovitz the rival. In my first week on the job, Eisner told me to fire Bob Iger. He thought Bob was stupid, or so he said. I thought he was being rash and said so. Bob Iger knows ABC cold. I later spent 3 hours over dinner with Iger, who'd heard of Eisner's dissatisfaction, persuading him not to leave. I told him Eisner had a short attention span and would soon be on to someone else. That was true. He promptly told me to fire Dennis Hightower, our head of television. Dennis was our only high-ranking African-American executive, and I told Michael, "That's a terrible idea for me or you." Hightower stayed. In 2005, after Eisner resigned under pressure and Iger replaced him, I finally grasped the method behind Eisner's madness. He saw Iger as a future successor. Bob has led Disney to new heights as CEO. He built the business with high-wire acquisitions and a stronger foreign profile, more or less what I tried a decade earlier. He made big M&A bets on Pixar, Marvel, Lucasfilm, and Fox, and built the Shanghai Disney Resort. Bob was smart about it. First, he changed the culture, dismantling the strategic planning group and erasing Eisner's imprint. And then he empowered the people around him, as any successful leader must. I still think I could have run a big public company, given time to learn and adjust, but I never could have run that company as Eisner's number two. Disney's culture under Michael was too ingrained and ingrown. I lacked the power to change it or the temperament to blend in. Burt Fields later told me that Eisner didn't want me at Disney so much as he wanted me out of CAA in order to weaken the agency's power, all agencies' power. I'd been a thorn in Disney's side for too long, so he pulled it out. Humiliating me every day was just a bonus. Right after I got fired, Teddy Forstman called and said, "I want you to go on the board of Gulfstream, an aerospace company his equity firm owned. It'll help you." "Thanks," I said, touched by his loyalty, "but I can't. It won't be good for Gulfstream. I'll be getting a lot of bad publicity." "You're on the board," he said, and hung up. The bad publicity came, and it was pretty bad. Headlines everywhere, stories of my fall. Within days of my departure, a group of Disney shareholders brought suit against the company and me. They charged that I'd broken my contract and that my $130 million no-fault payout was a fiduciary breach. In 2004, as the action headed toward trial in Delaware's Court of Chancery, I seized it as a chance for vindication. I was raring to go to tell the world what had really happened. The judge, Chancellor William B. Chandler III, was sharp and attentive, and after he listened to 37 days of testimony, his 175-page decision was strongly in my favor. Chandler found that I was a poor fit with my fellow executives at Disney, but he rejected the plaintiff's claim that I'd been untruthful or derelict in my duties. In approving my contract with the company, he observed, Disney's directors were well aware I needed downside protection before taking the job. I was walking away from up to $200 million in booked CAA commissions. My severance would offset my losses if I were fired without cause, which I was. While Chandler cleared the board of impropriety, he had harsh words for their conduct. Disney's directors fell significantly short of the best practices of ideal corporate governance, he wrote. He called Eisner a Machiavellian CEO who stacked his board with cronies and enthroned himself as the omnipotent and infallible monarch of his personal magic kingdom. That's the tragedy that can befall the company man. We come to believe we are the company. Chapter 19. The Third Valley. CAA was relentless in chasing new business, and whenever we gained a client, someone else lost one. When I left the agency after 20 years of dog-eat-dog, a lot of dogs out there had livid scars and long memories. You might think that I'd still have a few friends at CAA itself. After all, Ron and Bill and I had sold the agency to the new leadership team on fire sale terms, essentially floating them a zero-interest loan and having them pay us back out of earnings across 4 years. Also, the agency would continue to thrive. But when I was at Disney, Richard Lovett routinely spewed about me in staff meetings, neutralizing me the way I used to neutralize anyone who crossed us. Even years afterward, when Lovett ran the memorial services for Marty Baum and Ray Kurtzman, he refused to let me speak. Given how close I'd been to Marty and Ray, I found that very painful. Ryan Lord and Kevin Huvane felt the anxiety of influence, not wanting to be compared to me. Lord would later insist that the agency leave the IM Pay building and move to Century City. And David O'Connor, who I'd thought of as a friend, was mad at me because I hadn't included him among my designated heirs. That wasn't a verdict on his qualities. It was simply that, as a lit agent, David didn't generate nearly as much income as the others. The agency's new leaders included him in their ranks, then later pushed him out. The group had plenty of reasons to dislike me, I suppose. No one ever really likes the boss, especially one as demanding as I was, but they also felt that I'd abandoned them. Companies are families, too. I found it even more painful that Ron was still being less than complimentary about me to everyone. After I parted ways with Disney, I had lunch with him, trying to coax him to leave Universal and start a management or production company with me. I told him that ever since we'd suddenly stopped talking 30 times a day, it had been tougher on me than him because I wasn't pissed off. He could work his grievance out by venting, but I just felt deserted. He nodded, then said evenly that he had no interest in forming a company together. Ron also told me that he'd bought a place in Point Dune in Malibu and that he had his eye on the adjacent property, owned by Berry Gordy, but he said that at $5.5 million it was too expensive. I owned a place in Malibu, and I'd always wanted to buy Berry Gordy's place. Now, thinking that Ron was priced out, I did. A week later, Ron called incensed and said, "We have a problem. I went to buy Berry Gordy's house, and you have it in escrow. I was the one who told you about it, and I want to buy it." I told him I'd think about it, and that was our last conversation for years. The truth is, I was mad. I was stewing about remarks he'd made that had gotten back to me, that I was like Secretariat, hopeless without the right jockey, and I was stung that he had so little interest in working with me again. So I wanted him to sweat a little before I gave it to him, which led me to behave like an asshole. Ron called everyone, Herb Allen, Barry Diller, David Geffen, random people out of the phone book to complain about what I'd done, and the dispute wound up in the New York Times. A few weeks later, I finally gave him the property, handling the transaction through our mutual business manager, and Ron lives there to this day. In 1999, 2 years after my crash and burn at Disney, I formed a new production and management company, Artists Management Group. With my smart, accomplished partners, Rick and Julie Yorn, I intended for us to become the leading provider of mobile content, even as we kept a profitable foot in old media. The idea was that in their downtime after writing a television show, say, our creators would create 3-minute comedy episodes for mobile phones. Compile 7 of those, and you'd have a 21-minute episode of a sitcom. We'd push sports scores and restaurant information to your phones, as is now common, and make short-form television you could view on any screen. an idea Jeffrey Katzenberg got headlines for in 2017. Structurally, AMG was designed to be free from CAA's constraints. It could produce content and represent artists simultaneously, without any conflict. Scaling up quickly, we placed a stellar roster of writers under contract to our TV production arm, and in our first 6 months, we sold 13 TV pilots to the networks. And then, slowly at first, but with increasing speed, we did a faceplant. One big problem was that the smartphone adoption rate and bandwidth needed for large numbers of people to receive programming on their phones weren't in place yet. We taped Robin Williams reading the front page of the New York Times and riffing off it, a bit we thought would be a repeatable, snackable way of advertising our wares, but when we tried to upload it to Verizon's network, it simply didn't transmit. We intended to be 2 years ahead of everyone else, but we turned out to be 5 years ahead, not only of everyone else, but of the technology. We also ran into a gale force headwind from entrenched businesses like the TV networks, which felt threatened. From skeptics who badmouthed AMG all over town, and from CAA, which perceived our model as a dagger aimed at its heart. I had no intention of stealing the agency's clients, figuring there was plenty of work for everyone, but when Mike Menschel left CAA to join us and brought along his longtime client Robin Williams, the agency declared war. They told their clients that if any of them hired AMG as their managers, they'd lose CAA as their agents. The day after Richard Lovett announced this edict, Ron Meyer dropped by the agency to tell the staff, "You're doing the right thing." As AMG began to founder, CAA worked to poach Robin Williams back. I visited Robin in his dressing room at the Universal Amphitheater where he was performing and saw Brian Lord there. "Good God, who taught you that trick?" I thought. I wasn't shocked by Brian's behavior. He was doing what I would have done. I was shocked that Robin's wife, Marcia, had allowed Brian to infiltrate and undermine me. I remembered how grateful she'd seemed in the 90s when I'd gone to bat for her and Robin, reaming out People magazine for breaking its promise to the couple, and trumpeting the fact that Marcia had been Robin's nanny when they met. So I took her betrayal personally. I saw Marcia not long ago in San Francisco, and I felt sick to my stomach. Worse by far was that after Robin left, I heard that Barry Levinson was thinking of leaving too. Barry was my oldest client and one of my closest friends. We talked every day for 27 years. Each Christmas, he sent me a pint of Chivas Regal with a handwritten note about our year together, and I was always deeply touched. I went to Barry and begged him to stay. I said I was devastated, devastated, that he'd even think of doing that to me. He said it was done. He'd made a business decision. Friends, trying to cheer me up afterward, told me exactly that. "It's just business." I said, "No, it's not. What Barry and Robin and Marcia did to me when I was at my lowest moment, I carry that within me still." In April of 2000, I met Brian Lord to try to make peace with the agency. We took a walk around the outside of the CAA building, and I told him that my father was very ill with leukemia. He would die in June, and that I didn't want to fight with anyone anymore. I just wanted to run my business and let them run theirs. The following day, I received a 2-page handwritten letter from Brian laying out in precise, lawyerly detail all the reasons I was a horrible person. I got out of AMG in 2002, selling its assets to the firm and taking a loss of tens of millions. Days later, I made the spectacular miscalculation of meeting with a writer from Vanity Fair. By then, my joust with David Geffen was well into its third decade, and I had it on good authority that David and his friends had sabotaged the last-ditch financing I had needed to keep AMG going. On a mutual friend's advice, which turned out to be terrible, I'd even gone to see David in his offices at Amblin Entertainment and warned him that if he didn't stay out of my affairs, I'll beat the living shit out of you. He didn't stay out. So I vented to Vanity Fair. It would have been fine if I'd confined my remarks to Geffen, but in my fury, I characterized my various nemeses as the gay mafia. The idea was more absurd than poisonous because a number of the men I'd named, Michael Eisner, Bernie Brillstein, Bernie Weinraub at the New York Times, Ron Meyer, weren't gay. But the sentiment was as stupid as it was offensive, and both it and the loss of control that led me to utter it were out of character. Every problem I tried to solve, I now ended up making worse. The opposite of my traditional M.O. I'd always thought it was vital to mix business and friendship. I was learning, painfully, that it was better to keep those realms far apart. Business always gets personal. They only win if they kill you. They didn't kill me. In the years that followed, I tried to bring a pro football team to Los Angeles. Didn't happen. Long story. And to become the head of the International Red Cross. Didn't happen. End of story. I thought back on the career path I'd taken and realized that I would have been much happier as an artist or an architect. Happier in an arena where you don't make 5 new enemies every time you create something. Meanwhile, I turned my attention to Silicon Valley. Intrigued early on by software and the internet, I dreamed of remaking MGM or MCA as a digital age studio. In the early 90s, I flew to Redmond, Washington, and had a 4-hour dinner with Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer of Microsoft to talk about what was coming. I met with Andy Grove, the CEO of Intel, to see how our companies might mesh. And before I left CAA, Intel built a media lab there to give us a jump on the internet age. I picked the brains of dozens of tech innovators at Allen & Company retreats and other industry conclaves. I especially admired Ron Conway, the Bay Area's leading angel investor in embryonic startups. In 1999, Ron phoned to say, "I know a young man up here who's extraordinary. He's starting a company that's ahead of its time, and he'd like to meet you." The company was LoudCloud, and the young man was Mark Andreessen, who as an undergrad had invented the web browser. 3 years later, at 24, he monetized the browser as Netscape and landed on the cover of Time. 3 years after that, partnering with Ben Horowitz, Mark imagined how startups might use business software on the network, what people now call the cloud, instead of sinking capital into costly servers. Way ahead of the herd, he saw that everyone would soon be connected to the digital network. Wired magazine fittingly named him its first Wired icon under the headline, "The Man Who Makes the Future." When we met in an L.A. restaurant, I expected a geek from Central Casting. What I got was someone 6'5", an athletic-looking guy with a winning smile. He did dress like a geek. He was wearing patterned shorts and white socks, but he was hyper-articulate, insatiably curious, and voraciously well-read. He was Michael Crichton on steroids. Mark invited me north to meet with Ben Horowitz. Ben is a brilliant manager and entrepreneur in his own right, and together he and Mark were a formidable team. They asked me to join the LoudCloud board, and so began a new chapter of my life. Another board member was Bill Campbell, a legendary mentor to people like Steve Jobs at Apple and Sergey Brin and Larry Page at Google. I learned an enormous amount from Bill, who had nearly impeccable judgment. When the venture capital firm Kleiner Perkins sent him to Amazon to fire Jeff Bezos, Bill came back from their meeting and said, "You can't fire him." But at one point, he and I got into it in a board meeting. LoudCloud was in big trouble. Its stock had sunk below $1 a share and was about to be delisted. Bill thought we should just work our way through the rough patch, but I suggested that the board members demonstrate their faith in the company by buying stock. Bill, no fan of smoke and mirrors, screamed, "Ovitz, that's the dumbest fucking thing I've ever heard." After a shocked moment, everyone cracked up. I bought 500,000 shares of LoudCloud stock. Some of the other board members followed suit, and soon our shares were back up over $1. In 2007, Hewlett-Packard bought the company, now renamed Opsware, for $1.65 billion. As Mark and Ben led me into their world, I felt like a privileged student in a graduate school of one. After they sold Opsware, I asked Mark about joining their angel investment group. "Funny you should mention that," he said. "Ben and I are thinking about doing something more formal." As their venture capital firm began to take shape, I coached them about how to make Andreessen Horowitz stand out. The idea that took was to offer a full menu of business services, a novel approach in venture whose stars tend to be one-man bands who freelance out of a larger firm. In other words, Mark and Ben set out to be the CAA of Silicon Valley. They borrowed our roots to give themselves gravitas the same way I had borrowed from Lou Wasserman and Sun Tzu. In essence, the firm linked all the partners' networks and added specialists to strengthen the whole organism. No individual owns an account at Andreessen Horowitz. Investments are chosen by joint approval of the general partners, with the entire staff having a say. Then the team provides in-house experts to assist its startups with recruitment, budgeting, operations, sales, publicity, IPO rollouts, whatever an entrepreneur might need. While other venture firms seek out executive talent for their clients, Andreessen Horowitz goes further. It develops ties with the Valley's best software engineers, designers, and product managers, helping them with introductions and career counseling. At times, it connects these engineers and managers to one of its portfolio companies, but often there's no direct payoff. It does the same for top Valley executives, much as CAA negotiated employment contracts for studio executives. Andreessen Horowitz aims to forge long-term relationships that might eventually prove helpful at a future startup or as part of future deal flow. And Mark and Ben's thesis has worked brilliantly. They have rapidly established themselves as one of the nation's top five venture firms, with prescient investments in Facebook, Skype, Stripe, Airbnb, GitHub, Instacart, Lyft, and Pinterest, among many others. As Mark told the New York Times, "We'll wire up talent first with the goal of knowing and building relationships with all the best people. It's more like a Hollywood talent agency." Meanwhile, the talent agencies themselves have become small parts of giant conglomerates. A few years ago, a young exec at TPG, the private equity firm that has bought 52% of CAA, casually told me, "I own CAA." That hit me hard. CAA is still a force in entertainment, but the real heirs to Ron and me are Ari Emanuel and Patrick Whitesell, who've turned William Morris Endeavor into a multi-hyphenate business, a new octopus. Ari is now an agent, a producer, an advertiser, and an investment banker. Naturally, he trained at CAA, and naturally, Ari and Patrick met at Intertalent, which Ron Meyer worked so hard to put out of business. You can't kill the good ones. William Morris learned that after we left to start CAA, and CAA learned it when Ari and Patrick rose up to battle them. In 2009, I found myself at what I thought was a social dinner at a New York restaurant. Across the table were three dear friends, Mark Andreessen, his wife Laura, and Herb Allen III, the son of the Herb Allen who'd brought me to Sun Valley all those years ago. I'd known young Herb since he was 10, and he now ran the family business. I'd introduced him to Mark in 2000, believing that he should get the Allen firm out of old media and into tech, and that Mark would be the best possible advisor in that transition, and I felt as close to him as I did to his father. Herb had maintained his father's old-school style, the wood-paneled office walls, the sweater vests, and he possessed his father's quiet humor, indifference to trends, and outsized loyalty. This was my new inner circle. As I took my seat, I saw three solemn faces. Had someone died? "This," Mark said gravely, "is an intervention." I tensed, knowing what was coming. Lately, I'd been spending 2 days a week at Andreessen Horowitz. Now I was about to be triple-teamed into picking up stakes and making Northern California my base of operations. I spent my life solving other people's problems and steering the conversation away from myself, but that night I was trapped. First, Mark pounded on me, with Laura chiming in. Then Herb took over. I squirmed for 3 hours as they discussed how I needed to change. My face flushed, my ears rang. It's tough to resist heartfelt counsel from three people you trust, especially when they're three awfully smart people. As we rose from the table, Mark said, "Cortez, dude," his reference to the Spanish conquistador who burned his ships to prevent his crew from returning to Europe made me laugh. That night was the kick in the pants I needed. I tore up my travel schedule and flew the next day to San Francisco, where I took an apartment. Andreessen Horowitz made me a special partner and assigned me to several portfolio companies. I decided to study Silicon Valley the same way I'd studied the entertainment industry when I was 23. I began networking, taking 8 to 10 meetings a day with founders and engineers. At first, I wore a suit, then I left the tie at home, and pretty soon, I was business casual, which proved both more comfortable and a psychic relief. Many of the founders I met were dimly aware that I'd consulted with Steve Jobs, both about the entertainment business and later, after he bought Pixar, to help resolve tensions between him and Michael Eisner at Disney. That gave me some credibility, as did my work launching CAA, Hollywood's ultimate startup. So with the right introduction, it was relatively easy to get a meeting with almost anybody. I met with Peter Thiel and Max Levchin, who'd founded PayPal and become leading investors in tech. I met with Kevin Systrom, who'd founded Instagram. I met with Reid Hoffman, the LinkedIn founder. I took separate meetings at Facebook with Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg. I met with Eddie Q at Apple, and so on. 377 meetings that first year alone. Getting a second meeting with the superstars was harder. You had to prove in the first meeting you had something to offer, but I gradually developed a strong network, growing close not only to a number of founders, but also to venture capitalists, such as Michael Abramson, the youngest partner at Sequoia Capital, Josh Kushner of Thrive Capital, Steve Laughlin at Accel, Danny Reimer and Mike Volpe at Index Ventures, and tech banker Quincy Smith. The players in the Valley first made their marks in their 20s, as Ron and I did when we started CAA, so I felt right at home with the ambient energy and ambition. Young people make their own rules. I learned my most important lesson when two MIT engineers came to me with unproven technology to improve mobile payments. Acting as their agent, I called John Donahoe, the CEO of eBay, whom I'd met with earlier, and asked him to take a look for PayPal, which eBay had acquired. John brought two of his senior engineers to the meeting, and they began picking the code and the technology apart, asking nasty and insinuating questions. Accustomed to protecting my directors when studio execs got rough, I finally stood and told my guys, "They can't talk to you like this. We're going." The engineers stared at me and said, "What are you talking about? It's totally fine." I sat back down. eBay ended up buying the tech, and as we walked out, John Donahoe put his arm around me and said, "You've just learned something very important about the Valley. There are no manners here, just brain challenges. It's about getting to the truth of the idea any way you can." If Hollywood is like high school with money, as people often say, the lesson from that eBay meeting is that Silicon Valley is a true meritocracy. The best idea with the best execution wins. In Hollywood, I was always going to be judged against my own legacy at CAA, whereas in Silicon Valley, I was judged simply on the ideas I brought to the whiteboard. My big mistake, in retrospect, had been starting AMG when I should have moved to Silicon Valley and become a principal in the tech revolution. The Valley ringingly echoes my shouted belief that hard work and good ideas are an unstoppable combination. The press is full of worries about the rise of China, but I remember the same worries about Japan a generation back, and what I see in the tech community makes me confident that American ingenuity will withstand this challenge too. It wasn't long before taking general meetings began to pay off. In 2009, Peter Thiel, who'd funded the data analytics startup Palantir with $200 million from his own funds, asked me to help his CEO, Alex Karp, expand the company from working solely with the federal government and law enforcement into the world of business. We narrowed the potential areas to attack to three: health, where insights on disease vulnerability or drug efficacy could be teased out of big data; advertising, which had grown increasingly focused on metrics; and finance. Alex and I, who became fast friends, chose finance because the sector had gotten crushed in 2008 and the banks were eager for new ideas. At the next Allen conference that summer, I introduced Alex to Jimmy Lee, a top investment banker at J.P. Morgan, which I knew had been unable to reliably price its underwater mortgages in the wake of the Great Recession. Alex blew Jimmy away, and we made a deal with Morgan to launch a 3-month pilot program. Alex and I worked with Alex's co-founder, Stephen Cohen, and Stephen's engineers, Nima Gamsari and Roscoe Hill. They customized one of the company's algorithms so it would scrape thousands of hitherto uncorrelated data points about a given property and its location to determine a fair bid-ask spread. This allowed local branches to make speedy, accurate decisions. Settlements that used to take an average of 27 days now got done in 2. Jimmy Lee was overjoyed. Our success with mortgage pricing rapidly led to a spate of other ventures in banking. When I started working with Palantir, it had fewer than 100 engineers. Today it has 2,000. I was given advisor shares in the company, and I purchased an additional stake, betting on its future. Valued at $600 million then, Palantir is now valued at more than $20 billion. In the Valley, you only get paid for performance, and options vest slowly, usually over 4 years, but the upside can be much greater than in Hollywood. Through Alex, I met his brilliant co-founder, Joe Lonsdale, who was just leaving Palantir to launch a venture fund, Formation 8, as the fund went on to invest in hugely successful companies such as Oculus and Illumio. I advised Joe and got even more great advice in return. He was my roadmap to the Valley. He always knew where tech was going and which young entrepreneurs were going to take it there. I also became friends with Alex's engineers, Nima and Roscoe. In 2012, when they launched Blend, which allows you to secure a mortgage with just 10 clicks on your cell phone, I helped them raise seed money from Herb Allen, Peter Thiel, and Andreessen Horowitz. And I invested myself. Blend is currently valued at $500 million. When Roscoe went on to found Perpetua Labs, which advises companies how to grow by doing data analytics, I invested and began advising that company too. Ben Horowitz introduced me to three robotic engineering PhDs from Carnegie Mellon who were developing smart toys at a startup called Anki. Ben called me the minute they left him, and the minute I hung up with Ben, I drove to Anki's office, which was in the Skid Rowiest part of San Francisco's Mission District. I walked up a darkened staircase and knocked on an unprepossessing door. It opened onto a huge room that was empty except for three guys sitting around a card table and playing with slot cars. I happened to be a slot car freak, and I instantly fell in love with the fact that A, you could control their cars with your phone, and B, their cars didn't need slots. They were smart cars that could drive all over the floor. I began working with Anki's CEO, Boris Sofman, and his two co-founders, Hans Stepiner and Mark Palatucci, and soon, much more thanks to them than me, the company had a great second product, a personalized, plucky, 6-inch robot named Cosmo. Through a founder's fund, venture capitalist named Brian Singerman, one of the best young investors I have met in the Valley, I invested in and began advising Stemcentrix, a bioscience company exploring novel ways to cure cancer. Stemcentrix eventually sold to AbbVie for $9 billion, and I got a 4x return as well as a terrific science education. One thing I really love about Silicon Valley is that each day brings you different fascinating problems, and you're always learning how the world, and sometimes the universe, works. I also consulted for an amazing entrepreneur named Gurjeet Singh, a PhD in applied mathematics, who was the founding CEO of a big data sifting business called Iasti. A remarkably composed man, Gurjeet taught me a lot about life. After his grandmother died, he remained steadfastly cheerful, and I said, "How are you able to be that way? My mother died 2 years ago, and I still grieve for her every day." He said, "Well, as a Sikh, I believe she's going to come back, so I'm happy for her." That gave me a comforting way to think about my parents' death, at a time when I'm beginning to contemplate my own. I'm now working with at least 25 other companies, and new ones get in touch every week. I find that my value add, as they say, is advising on how to monetize a technology, how to market it, and how to avoid some of the pitfalls I fell into at CAA. I don't always know the right move, who does, but I can often help steer founders away from mistakes of inexperience, from making short-sighted hires or needlessly alienating a rival who might become a collaborator, or not planning for the long term. Founders are much more interested in my mistakes, which can often be generalized to their situation, than in my successes, which were often particular to the agency business. When I met Brian Chesky in 2013, I was astounded that this 2004 graduate of the Rhode Island School of Design, a former competitive bodybuilder with no coding experience, had co-founded and led one of the great startups of his era, the sharing economy juggernaut that is Airbnb. After providing occasional help to Airbnb over the years, I recently met with Brian to brainstorm about how Airbnb could keep growing. In one of our sessions, we discussed an end-to-end or door-to-door experience and spent 3 hours whiteboarding how the company could curate your entire trip from the time you left home. I told him, go larger, tackle the total vacation experience. The following year, Airbnb announced its Trips service, where hosts will introduce travelers who want to experience local living, from everything to a dinner party to a Tai Chi class. It's currently available in 51 cities around the world. Brian asked, "How did you learn to think so big at CAA?" I reminded him that Airbnb had consistently thought big. It hadn't been at all content with its original business of renting out air mattresses on floors. Then I added that one way to conceptualize how to think in business is a martial arts precept. If you aim at the target, you lose all your power. You have to hit through the target to really smash it. To get where you want to go, you have to set out to go even further. In 1998, once our kids were all out of the house for good, I began building my dream home in Beverly Hills, high on the hillside. It's essentially three interlocking boxes made only of glass, oak, plaster, and steel. A house that doubles as an art gallery, it reminds visitors of a miniature MoMA with bedrooms. It contains my favorite paintings and sculptures from 40 years of collecting, modern and contemporary paintings, Ming furniture, African antiquities, Rembrandt etchings, and turn-of-the-century Japanese bronze flower vases, as well as my library of more than 3,000 art monographs. The design and build of the house took 11 years, and I drove my architect, Michael Maltzen, crazy. I had the contractor redo the plaster three times till it was perfectly smooth. I also had him fine-tune the reveals, or tiny strips at the base of the walls, to get them just so, which required a team of six guys with sandpaper and toothbrushes. The worst day of all was the day I moved in, because then it was done. At around the same time, my life took an unexpected turn. After being together since we were teenagers, Judy and I recognized that our lifestyles had diverged. She drawn to her horse ranch in Ojai, I migrating from L.A. to the Bay Area to New York, always on the move. We agreed to live our lives separately, though we'd remain married and the best of friends. We still talk almost every day. In 2010, at Ted Forstman's Aspen Conference, I met a woman I'd encountered several times before, but this time was different. We had a drink, which became a dinner, which became a conversation that shows no signs of slowing down. Tamara Mellon and I love a lot of the same books and movies and art. We enjoy learning new things in each other's worlds. Best of all, we find ourselves laughing all the time. Tamara is gifted, witty, and kind enough to laugh at my jokes. She appreciates my eclectic interests and loves that I love what she does. She co-founded Jimmy Choo at 27, almost exactly my age when we founded CAA. She built the company by designing thousands of women's shoes and bags, many of them now iconic. After a bruising struggle with the company's shareholders, she is now creating a new business. I'm having a blast watching her and making suggestions to protect her interests. An added treat is Tamara's 15-year-old daughter, Minty. She designed her own clothes at an early age, competes in national horseback riding tournaments, and is socially graceful with a wide circle of friends. It's daunting to have a teenage daughter in my life again, but it's also tremendous fun. She's always playing me new music and introducing me to fashion trends. Because of her, I knew about Snapchat the instant it came out. I was touched when, for her 11th birthday, she asked me to get her a cake with a Liechtenstein painting on it. Minty has become totally enmeshed with my family. Eric lives in L.A. and is married to a delightful woman named Kendall, who brings him to life and makes him happy. He's always been his own man. After becoming an early employee of the gaming company Zynga, he used the money he made there to put himself through Northwestern Law School, and now he hopes to work for the FBI. Somehow, he came out Republican despite my best efforts, so I know he'd make a great G-man. He and Kendall are now expecting their first child. Kim, the artist in our family, started a fashion business in her 20s called Kimberly Ovitz. I was impressed and pleased that her first line, which featured lots of monochrome black and white, was heavily influenced by minimal artists like Ed Reinhardt, Ellsworth Kelly, and Robert Ryman. Likewise, Eric haunts museums, and Chris is buying numerous prints for his house. Kim also lives in L.A., and in addition to her work as a designer, she consults with numerous fashion and digital companies on marketing and strategy. Jordan Harris, who's still a vital part of our family 15 years later, he was the best man at Chris's wedding, is now at NYU's Stern School of Business while working at Code Advisors. He has a real interest in tech. I also tried for years to get Chris to go into tech and to move to San Francisco. I had him meet with Mark Andreessen and Peter Thiel, and they tried to talk him into moving to the city, but he stayed in Los Angeles to make his own way, and he finally did. At the Goldman Sachs Internet Conference a few years ago, I stood apart with the bank's Gary Cohn, later to become Donald Trump's first economic advisor, and watched Chris work the room. Gary grinned, recognizing my bursting pride. Chris may have learned the social skills from me, but he was much more candid and factual with the people he was talking to than I ever was. He wasn't trying to sell them. Chris is now working on his third startup, WorkPop, an HR technology company disrupting the service economy. I never make an angel investment without running it by Chris and his wife, Ara Katz. Ara is an entrepreneur who is the co-founder of Seed, which is focused on improving consumers' health through the microbiome, and she is a gentle, deeply grounded soul. To my surprise, I thought she was a touchy-feely hippie when I met her, she's become the core of our family and someone whose perspective I rely on constantly. Chris and Ara recently had a boy, Pax, and I FaceTime with him every day if we're not together. He is the light of my life. Ara is the best mother I've ever seen. She's totally anti-screen, except for FaceTime. And Pax reminds me of me as a little boy, the curious and emotional kid I was before Sarah got her hooks into me. As a grandfather, I plan to do everything right, to fix the numerous mistakes I made as a parent. Chapter 20. Gentlemen. Over the years, I kept hearing that Ron was still furious at me. Someone who was on Universal's plane with him recently told me, "He ripped you for 30 minutes. It sounded like you and he had just had a fight yesterday." I finally had had enough. A couple of years ago, I called Ron and said, "Look, everywhere I go, I keep hearing from people that you're saying terrible things about me. I'm sure some of your complaints are completely justified, but they can't all be, because we had 25 good years together. We're getting up there in age, and I'd like not to leave the planet with this breach between us." Somewhat to my surprise, he instantly said, "I'd like that too. We met for lunch at my Japanese place, Hamasaku. I opened it on a lark 16 years ago in a Korean strip mall in Westwood, and it's become quite popular. It's so non-chic, it's chic." After shaking hands and sizing each other up, we made some small talk as we looked over the menus. It felt both uncomfortable and strangely warmly familiar. Over sushi, we discussed how to work through our issues, or if we even could. We left a second meeting up in the air. After pondering the problem, I called Ron and said, "I think it'd be best if we had a mediator who can listen to both of us and help us interpret each other, and referee if necessary. Why don't you come up with some possible people, and I'll come up with some, and we'll find someone who works for both of us." I was trying to be sensitive to him for a change. "Why don't you do it?" he said. "I'm sure whoever you pick will be great." Same old Ron. I found a UCLA professor to mediate. Ron and I met at a coffee shop in the basement of her office and then went up to her office for a two-hour session, our first of three. Ron started talking and didn't stop for half an hour. He immediately acknowledged that he'd spent 20 years denigrating me to anyone who would listen. He said, "I was the guy taking care of the agency while you were running around all over the world. You had the big profile, but I was doing all the hard work. And you should have bought out Bill Haber and given me the stock. I deserved it." I said that he wasn't generating the income I was. He responded that without him, the business would have fallen apart. I said, "Look, I was insensitive to you. I wasn't going to get rid of Haber because I was scared to rock the boat. But I should have done something, anything." He said he was still furious and resentful about the house in Malibu, but when I started to explain, he talked over me. He wasn't going to let me express my feelings. He was still the keeper of our collective emotions. So the first session didn't end particularly well. The second one went better with the mediator's help. I got a chance to apologize, and Ron accepted my apology and seemed mollified. Then he owned up to all his rancor and sabotage, which was a form of apology, or at least of candor. Yet, even as we worked to get our feelings out, I felt destroyed because Ron kept confirming my worst fears. Every time anyone in town had struck a match of accusation against me, Ron had dumped on a truckload of gas. "No one was better equipped to put you away than me," he said. I told him, Ron, you were unhappy at CAA, so you kind of shoved it to me. I apologize for missing the signs that you were unhappy, but you could have just told me. He smiled a little and said, yeah, but you didn't want to hear it. After the sessions, we began meeting for lunch. We even brought Tamara and Ron's wife, Kelly, into it. Just like old times, sort of. He'd talk about his job, I'd talk about how I don't have a job. Ron followed up, he checked in, he was courteous and thoughtful, he made me feel like I was the only thing on his mind. It was seductive, particularly as more and more time passed without strife. But a voice in my head kept saying, you were wrong about his feelings for the last 10 years at CAA. He handled you beautifully then, so what makes you certain you're right now? Part of me wanted to believe in his sincerity and the promise of our old friendship. Part of me was still angry. Part of me felt sorry for him. Part of me felt sorry for both of us. Still, we began talking 2-3 times a week, easing toward a renewal of our intimacy. I'd missed it, so. In September of 2016, Ron and I were publicly interviewed together one night by Jim Miller, who just published an oral history of CAA. I had to walk into the Directors Guild Theater using a cane, having just had surgery to fuse my entire spine. Under my suit, I was wearing a brace that made me look like a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle, and I was in considerable pain. The doctors told me that 90% of the reason my spine was so damaged was that I'd exercised every day of my life, never giving my body a rest, and absorbed all those punishing hits and falls in martial arts. I would have laughed hearing that, only it hurt too much. The two of us had agreed before the event not to go negative. My goal for the evening was to defuse the feud in public, and I think Ron's goal was to demonstrate that he was the Mr. Nice Guy of legend. But neither of us knew what might get said if we really got back into it. Just before going on stage, Ron and I went into the bathroom. As we each stood at a urinal, who should come in to piss alongside us but Jeffrey Katzenberg, who in Miller's book had said that I consistently dealt in ways that were destructive, deceitful, and in bad faith. Look who's talking, I thought. We both said, hello, but it was awkward. After pissing on each other for years, here we all were pissing side by side. Welcome back to Hollywood. Marn and I walked on stage to a warm round of applause. All 600 seats were filled. I saw old colleagues like Rick Nasita and Sandy Kleiman and John Patak and Fred Spector and Paula Wagner, as well as a number of producers, including Larry Gordon and Joel Silver. All the industry trade papers and websites were there, too, eager to take the measure of what had become a legendary success story and implosion. Jim Miller started us talking about the years at William Morris when we signed Rob Reiner and Sally Struthers together. And Ron got a big laugh when he called the agency's Sam Weisbord an ugly little piece of shit guy. When we got into the founding of CAA, Ron said, Mike was the natural leader. There was never a question. The conversation was affable and reflective. I recalled how he and I planned our moves together 30 times a day, and Ron won more laughs when he said, it was a much more gentlemanly business before we started. Once Mike and I were let loose, no one was safe. He added, confirming my core belief, there was no one else who understood what we were doing or how we were doing it except each other. When Miller inquired about the roots of our breach, Ron soft-pedaled the issue, saying that my move into corporate deal-making was organic. Our clients weren't adversely affected by it, and more business was coming in. But he noted poignantly, it was much more personal to me because my focus on bigger game made him feel less worthy, made him feel disenfranchised from our relationship. I jumped in to say that I'd been blind to his feelings and that in trying to build a wider network, I didn't realize I was sacrificing relationships that were more important to me. Ron said, I also have some responsibility. I did not tell Mike that I was unhappy. I felt that if I had confronted Mike, he wouldn't have handled it well and I would have put the place on tilt. But we were both finally realizing on stage was that we'd each unwittingly sacrificed our relationship in order to save CAA, whereas if we'd just focused on making sure we were both happy, CAA would have done even better. The irony was right out of O. Henry. We discussed the ugly breakup calmly, and at last we got to Berry Gordy's Malibu house. I decided, weighing the crowd, Ron, and my own feelings, to finally fess up. "I was pissed off," I said. "I made a mistake. I shouldn't have bought the property." I looked out at the crowd and waited a beat, using timing I'd picked up from David Letterman. "One of the reasons I made the mistake," I added, jerking my head at Ron, "was I didn't have him to advise me not to." Ron grinned, and the audience broke up. Afterward, I basked in the kind words and notes of appreciation from old friends and colleagues. The lore had long been that I screwed Ron over and got my just desserts, but that evening seemed to shift the communal storyline some and make people realize that it had been a folie à deux. Nearly everyone was astonished to see a vulnerable, ruminative Michael Ovitz, the me I'd always kept hidden. At CAA, I wouldn't have known how to show that side of myself, or wanted to. That same reconciling impulse made me reach out to David Geffen. We met at Marea in New York, shook hands, and had a civil lunch. He told me, "My biggest problem with you was that I tried to be your friend, but you wouldn't be friends with me." The old me would have argued, would have objected that that wasn't the whole story, but I just said, "You're right." I was there to make peace, and David said he wanted the same. We were two guys in our 70s, looking to fix what we'd broken. Ronnie later told me that David didn't have anything bad to say about me afterward. That made me smile a little. The wind nowadays is breaking even, but I'll take it. A few months back, I visited the old CAA building, which I still own. After Ron and Bill left the agency, I bought them out of the building. They were afraid that no one would want to occupy it if CAA left. Operating out of fear is bad business. 3 months after the agency's departure, Sony leased the building from me for 20 years. But now, the building was empty again, needing a new tenant, so I took a tour. Sony had divided my not-huge office into two small offices. Well, fair enough. The atrium was still airy and inspiring, yet it had no one to catalyze anymore, no one to inspire. The building felt drained, empty, not just of the old bustle, but of the magic, the power. It felt small. It felt like your childhood house does when you go back as an adult. When we first inhabited the building, the whole mighty team of us, we were giants. We could walk outside and reach downtown, the Pacific, or Tokyo in a single bound. I was hit by the magnitude of what I'd done in that building, and it seemed kind of amazing. This kid from the valley, with no stature, no tenure, no network to rely on, reshaping the entertainment business. Bullied as a child, I spent my life bullying back. My clients sometimes viewed me as a superhero, and I did try to play that role, swooping in to help anyone who was down or ill or just in need of advice, fighting for the underdogs. I thought I was one of the good guys, yet I was increasingly visited by the doubt that troubles every superhero. Had I become a vigilante? Plenty of people saw me as just that, a hired gun who took the law into his own hands. But that verdict misses all the loyalty and the love. Bob De Niro summed me up pretty well. Someone once asked him, "Why don't you leave Ovitz? He's such a tough asshole." De Niro said, "Yeah, but he's my tough asshole." In my empty fortress, I realized that I wasn't out of the valley yet. I'm free of it in my daily life and in my bank account, but I'll never be free of it in my brain. You carry your origins with you. Still, those origins drove me here and built this place and attracted so many bright, funny, creative colleagues. In the silence, I discovered that the only thing I really miss about the agency business was the camaraderie, my comrades and friends, and the passionate way we spent our lives together. I miss the people. This is Dennis Boutsakaris. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Who is Michael Ovitz? A memoir by Michael Ovitz. This program was directed by Paul Rubin. Executive producer, Laura Wilson. Text copyright 2018 by Michael Ovitz. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.